couple of years ago, probably 2.5 years now, I got this huge warning system going off in my Honda CR-V. 11 different warning systems, all starting to go off in my car. And a normal person would have taken their car to the mechanic immediately. But I am the biggest cheapskate in the history of ever. And so I continued to drive my car with all 11 warning lights going off. And I know there were 11 because it's been 2.5 years. And every time I start my car, I have to hit this button to cycle through all of the warning signals to get back to my main dashboard. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 every single time. And for a while, it was no big deal. Like, it was just the warning signs were going off and nothing was happening with my car. The car wasn't overheating. There were no real issues. But then, probably about 6 months ago, I would come to a stop sign and I would go to hit the gas and my car would just not go. I come to find out that my car was going into something called limp mode. I never heard of this before, but it's something major. When you've got something major going on in your engine, this is what happens to your car, right? That was 6 months ago. Here we are, fast forward. It's December, and it is happening to me in my car literally 6 times a day in my car. And finally, what did I do? I finally took my car to the mechanic, right? There's a problem with your car, Justin. You need to do something about this problem, because if you don't, here's what's gonna happen. Your car engine is probably going to explode and you are gonna have a significantly bigger problem on your hands. In fact, I would argue, my guess is I'm probably gonna get it to the mechanic, finally get them to look at this thing, and they're gonna be like, dude, you should have brought this in a long, long time ago. And because you didn't, you might have a whole lot more problems than you would have if you had just brought it in 2.5 years ago. And that got me thinking about something this week. I think as human beings, as humanity, there are warning signs all around us. Warning signs that there is a problem. There's something going on inside the hearts of human beings that's destroying them. It's devastating our world. And the warning signs are, they're going off everywhere. They're going off inside of you. They're going off inside of other people. We look around the world, we see it, right? We see the destruction. We see the relational chaos. We see the way that people treat other people. I mean, it's crazy when you look around the world how much devastation there is. And whether people want to admit it or not, the problem is inside of us. We are the problem. Our hearts are the problem. And yet what is so amazing to me is how many people do not want to admit there's a problem. Just like me in my Honda CR-V for 2.5 years, ignoring the warning lights. We don't want to admit there's a problem. We don't want to have to face the consequences of what that problem is, right? I didn't take my car to the mechanic because I'm cheap and I just didn't want to have to pay the bill. But the reality is, at some point, you're going to have to address it. You're going to have to take care of it. And when you do, you better take it to someone who can actually do something about that problem. If I take my car to Allegheny General Hospital, drive in there, walk in, and ask the doctors and the nurses there to fix my car, what's going to happen? They're going to laugh at me. Or they're going to get laughed right off of the campus. Right? No, if you have a car problem, what do? You take your car to the mechanic. You take it to the person who can actually do something about it. And yet, here's what I feel about society and our culture and our world and humanity. We have a spiritual problem. There's a problem going on inside of here, and we are taking it to everything but the one thing. that can actually do something about that problem. We're looking for the answer to this void. Come on, don't we feel it sometimes? The emptiness, the anxiousness that goes on inside of the human heart, the fear that goes on inside of a human heart. For some people, just a deep, deep depression and despair and a hopelessness. And yet we keep looking for the answer in all the wrong places. And what I know, and what many of you who are sitting here know, is that it is Jesus Christ that is the answer to the problem that our world is facing. And yet this is what fascinates me. What amazes me is that in spite of mounds and mounds of evidence, both historical and testimonial through the lives of people who have been transformed by Jesus Christ, is how many people continue to reject him as the answer to the problem. It amazes me. And what we do here at True North Church is this. It is our mission to help people see he is the answer. That's why we exist as a church, as a people, as the people of God, to show people, to point people to the one thing that will actually truly change their life. So we've been in a series for the last few weeks that we're just calling Mark Season 2. We're working verse by verse through the Gospel of Mark. It's one of the four Gospels, four books in the New Testament that chronicle the life and ministry of Jesus Christ. They're the four most important books that have ever been written. And one of the things that fascinates me about the life of Jesus and his ministry were the two sides, the two groups of people, essentially, that he was constantly running into. There were those who wanted Jesus, who accepted him, who wanted what he had to offer, and there were those who consistently, over and over again, rejected what he had to offer. Over the last few weeks, we've seen this, right? We've seen him in Capernaum, where his home base is kind of set up for his ministry. And we've seen people coming to him, crowds mobbing him, wanting to hear from him. Hear from his teaching, for him to heal them and perform miracles for them. We've also seen him travel across the Sea of Galilee from Capernaum right to the other side of the lake where nobody wanted him, where he performed a miracle, released some people from demon possession, and they were like, get out of here. We don't want anything to do with you. And he comes back over, right? We're playing this little back and forth on the Sea of Galilee over the last few weeks. He comes back over to Capernaum. Last week, we saw Jesus healing two people, a woman who has been bleeding for 12 years and a little girl who has died, and he raises her back to life. The father, Jairus, of that little girl and this woman who's been bleeding for 12 years, the complete opposite of the people on the other side of the lake, right? They want Jesus. They believe in his power. They believe what he can do, how he can change the course of their life. And so we're seeing this back and forth. And today, what we're going to see again is another group of people who reject Jesus. And this one, for me, might be the most astonishing one of them all. Because it's in his own town. It's in the home town that he grew up in. And of all the places that you would have thought they would have welcomed Jesus with open arms, they would have rolled out the red carpet for him, you would have thought it would have been there. And yet that is not what happens. And I think there is so much for us to learn today from this very simple, quick little kind of sidebar stop in the life of Jesus that Mark chronicles here in his gospel. Sometimes I wonder, why in the world, like, some of the stuff that's in here, it's like, why did God put this in here? Why did he want this in here? Well, I promise you this. If you take the time to really study it, to understand the context of what's going on here, everything that's in this book makes sense and is meant to be here and has a purpose for your life. Not just, it wasn't just for them 2,000 years ago. It is for us today. And so we're going to pick back up in Mark chapter 6. I encourage you always, if you're new joining with us today, we say this around here almost every week, nothing will change your life more than you getting into the Word of God daily. And so we encourage you, bring your Bibles, even if it's on your phone. If you don't have Bibles today, the words will be up on the screen. We'll put the text on the screen. But I encourage you, go home and study this out for yourself this week. Spend some time thinking about what we talk about today. This is meant to be a springboard for you to go home and to pray on this and to reflect on this and for it to actually impact your life. And so let's pick this up. Mark chapter 6, starting in verse 1. It says, Jesus left there and went to his hometown, accompanied by his disciples. When the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were amazed. Where did this man get these things, they asked. What's this wisdom that has been given him? What are these remarkable miracles he is performing? Isn't this the carpenter? Isn't this Mary's son? And the brother of James, Joseph, Judas, and Simon? Aren't his sisters here with us? And they took offense at him. Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his own town, among his relatives, and in his own home. And it says he could not do any miracles there except to lay his hands on a few sick people and heal them. And he was amazed at their lack of faith. Then Jesus went around teaching from village to village. So let's break this down this morning. First of all, it tells us this, that Jesus left there and went to his hometown accompanied by his disciples. Now we already know where there is, right? Because in the text we looked at last week, where was he? He was in Capernaum doing these miracles, right? And so he leaves Capernaum. And the first thing I want us to see about this is he leaves Capernaum and he's going to his hometown of Nazareth, which is about 40 miles southwest of Capernaum. Not only is he going to his hometown, but he's taking his disciples with him. And that's an important detail. He's not just going to his hometown to just go visit his mommy. He's going there with a very specific goal in mind. There is ministry to be done, and there are things that his disciples need to see in his hometown. And so they make this trek from the Sea of Galilee to Nazareth. And Nazareth is like, I mean, you want to talk about a blip on the radar. It's a blip on the map, right? Multiple times in scripture, people say this terminology about Nazareth. What good can possibly come from Nazareth? Can anything good come from there? When they hear that that's where Jesus is from, they're like, this can't be anybody special. This can't be anybody with authority. He's from Nazareth, right? Nazareth was no bigger than maybe 6 square miles. Probably about 500 people is what historians estimate lived there at that time. And so it was really, really small town. It's the kind of town where everybody knows everybody. Everybody's all up in everybody else's business. Anybody else come from a small town, right? Grow up in a small town? I did, right? You know what's going on in everybody's lives, right? It's a Cheers kind of town, right? Where everybody knows your name, right? Come on. Cheers, right? Some of you Gen Zers are like, what is he talking about? I never heard of Cheers. It was on in the 80s, all right? The greatest decade that has ever been. It's a small town, okay? It's a tiny little nothing town where everybody knows everybody else. And Jesus is going there with a purpose. He's got a plan. He's got a mission, right? And so he brings his disciples along. He gets to Nazareth, and this is what it says happens next. It says, when the Sabbath came, he began to teach in the synagogue, and many who heard him were amazed. Where did this man get these things? They asked. What's this wisdom that he has? What are these remarkable miracles he's performing? Isn't this the carpenter? Isn't this Mary's son, the brother of James and Joseph and Judas and Simon? Aren't his sisters also here with us? And they took offense at him. Once again, a small detail here that I think is really important. It says, when the Sabbath came. So do you know what that tells me? Jesus was there for a little bit of time before anybody actually came with any kind of interest to hear what he had to say. Now, this is very different from what we've seen throughout the rest of Mark's account. Everywhere Jesus goes at this point, this dude is being mobbed. There are crowds, huge crowds forming everywhere to listen to Jesus and to see him do miracles. He gets to his own town, and it's days probably, before anybody comes to actually listen to him, before anybody comes looking to hear from Jesus. And even then, they're just showing up to church essentially on Sunday morning because that's what you're supposed to do. They're not really that interested in what Jesus has to say. And that's telling. It tells us something about the mindset and the heart of the people in Nazareth. Right now, it does say that once he did begin to teach in the synagogue, that they were amazed. They were amazed. And we see this often when people encounter Jesus. They are blown away by his teaching, by his authority, the way in which he speaks. They've never heard anything like this guy before. Never. There's a Greek word, ekplasso. And what it actually means is to strike or blast. To strike or blast. So the imagery here, the vernacular here is this. He blew their minds. He blew their minds with the things that he was teaching them. They couldn't believe what they were hearing coming from this Jesus. But I think what's so important to see here is this. It wasn't just the teaching that was blowing their mind. It was who was teaching them. It was who these amazing things were coming from. Right? Because we're gonna see here in a second, they burn Jesus pretty hard here. Right? They throw some things at him that are frankly major disses. They are not kind to Jesus. Right, he begins to teach and they were amazed, and then they start to question though. Right? Their amazement, it quickly turns to resentment. What do they say? Right, let's just walk through some of these. First of all, he says, who is this man, they said. Who is this guy? Who does he think he is? Waltzing up in here, teaching with this authority, telling us how to live our lives. Who do you think you are, Jesus? And why do they think that about him? Because they're looking at Jesus and they're like, we know you. We know that you grew up in this town. We know who your mother is and who your brothers and your sister are. We know what you used to do for a living. And now you're here talking to us like you went to the greatest rabbi school in the land and you're some highly educated hoity-toity dude coming in here telling us what to do. Who is this guy? Who do you think you are? Jesus, you're just a carpenter. The word there, the Greek word that's used there is this word tekton. A carpenter in those days was simply someone who worked with their hands to build things. Most likely, Jesus probably built plows for farming. He may have helped build some of the structures in the area, maybe even some of the famous ones in the area. Built homes. He was a tekton. It's the word that we get architect from. And he was essentially a craftsman. And that job in those days was not seen very favorably. It was a blue-collar job that did not require much education, and they were not looked highly upon. So once again, who does this guy think he is? coming in here and speaking to us like this. You're nothing more than a blue-collar carpenter, dude. Who do you think you are? Not only that, but now they take it a step further. They take a dig at his mom. Now, I don't know about you, but you don't mess with my mom, all right? If I was Jesus, I would have been upset, man. What do they say? This is Mary's son? Now, context, again, really important here. In those days, you were never identified with your mother. You were always identified with your father. This is the way that it was. So if anybody was describing who Jesus was, they would have said, isn't this Joseph's son? That's not what they say, though. And you want to know why? This is a major dig at Mary. Isn't this the illegitimate son of Mary? Don't you remember how this guy was conceived, right? Oh, they made up this whole story about it was God's child and she was a virgin and yeah, come on. Does anybody around here really believe that? You're the illegitimate son of Mary. Who are you to tell us anything? Not only that, but you got these brothers and sisters. We know your brothers and sisters. We know your family, dude. Yeah, we've seen the way you guys interact with each other. We've seen the kind of people your family is. And you're telling us you're some special rabbi? Come on, Jesus. Right, and the bottom line here is this. This is what it says, they took offense at him. They were majorly, majorly offended by Jesus. There's another Greek word. And I think these original words, this original language is so important for us to actually understand what's happening here. It's this word scandalizo. When it says they were offended by him. This word scandalizo, it's where we get the word scandalized. They were scandalized by him being there. They were ashamed of him. They were ashamed to be associated with him. Don't be going around telling people you're from Nazareth, Jesus. Because you're making us look bad. Right? They didn't want to be associated with him in any way. There's like this deep embarrassment. One of my favorite Christmas movies, I feel like people either love it or hate it, is Christmas Vacation. National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation. And there is a character in National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation that is honestly one of my favorite all-time characters. His name is Cousin Eddie. And Cousin Eddie is a piece of work. He's that family member that you're just like, man, he's part of the family, but he is not part of the family. Right? And so in Christmas Vacation, if you've ever seen this movie, he shows up to Christmas at the Griswold home, unannounced. He's not really welcome there. Nobody invited him, but he just shows up in his disgusting robe, emptying his latrine from his RV into the sewer in the street. And Clark Griswold is just beside himself. I am embarrassed, right? He is embarrassed. He is ashamed to say that this dude is part of his family. I mean, come on, everybody's got a Cousin Eddie, don't they, in their family, right? And if you don't, it's probably you. So just saying, all right? Right? Everybody's got a Cousin Eddie. Everybody's got that one person you're just like, man, they're going to want to talk politics or they're going to want to, you know, some conspiracy theory this week or, you know, whatever it is, right? We've all got that family member. And this is how they saw Jesus. Now, please hear me out. Some of you are probably like, did the pastor just compare Jesus to Cousin Eddie from Christmas Vacation? Because that feels really wrong. And it is, because Jesus was nothing like Cousin Eddie. I would have given anything to spend 5 minutes in the presence of Jesus. I mean, he's humble. He's the wisdom that he has, the compassion that he has for people. I mean, it must have been incredible. And yet, they don't want to have anything to do with him. They reject him. And my question that I've been thinking about this all week is, why are they so offended by Jesus? Why do they feel so scandalized by Jesus? Because he is no Cousin Eddie. He's perfect in every way. He never sinned. He's righteous and holy in every possible way, loving and good and faithful in every possible way. Why do they reject him? Well, Jesus tells us. Look at verse 4. It says, Jesus said to them, a prophet is not without honor except in his own town, among his relatives, and in his own home. A prophet is not without honor except in his own town. We have a saying, a modern saying, that essentially means the exact same thing. What Jesus is speaking here is an old proverb. But our language today would go something like this: familiarity breeds contempt. You've heard that before? Right? Familiarity breeds contempt, right? They grew up around Jesus. They saw the way Jesus was human. He was normal. He was just like everybody else in their eyes. There's nothing special about Jesus. That's what they thought. There's nothing special about him. It's like when brothers grow up with each other, right? Siblings grow up with each other, and you see all the things they do, right? Dude, you ate your own boogers when you were 6. I know you. I know the things that you did. I know the way that you acted. And now, you want me to think there's something special about you? No. No, I don't believe it. And we saw this with the way that his own family even treated him. If you read through the New Testament, you see that his brothers, many of his brothers, did not believe that he was God, that he was the Messiah, until after he was crucified and resurrected. They didn't believe it. They didn't want to believe it. Right? I mean, think about it. Come on, you know this. I mean, I wonder sometimes, truly, I wonder if I went back to my little hometown and saw somebody that I hadn't met for, talked to for 25 years, knew me as a teenager. Let me tell you, teenage Justin. And I said, yeah, I'm a pastor now. I think they would look at me and be like, what? Really? You're a pastor. Listen, nobody's more surprised than me. I can't believe that you, the guy I knew, the guy I kind of palled around with, some of the things I heard you say when you were a teenager, some of the things I saw you do, you're a pastor now? Again, this is what they would have been essentially feeling in this moment. Here's what they believe, right? Jesus never sinned. He was perfect in every way. But they saw him as ordinary. In their mind, he was just this ordinary human being. And because of that, because they rejected him, this is what it says. I think this is the saddest part of this whole account. It says he could do no miracles there, except lay his hands on a few sick people and heal them. He was amazed at their lack of faith, it says. And then Jesus went around teaching from village to village. Now, I want to make something really clear here, because I've actually heard some very famous pastors and preachers actually say that because they didn't have enough faith, Jesus was powerless to overcome their faith. That's blasphemy. Blasphemy. No, instead, what Jesus is doing here is he is withdrawing his power because of their unbelief. Because their hearts are so hardened to him and so cold to him, he's like, I'm moving on. It says he healed a few people. Maybe those people did come to him and say, hey, I believe. He healed a few people, but for the most part, their hard hearts drove him away. Jesus wasn't going to force himself on them. It's part of what I love about God. He does give us choice. He gives us the opportunity to come to him. And he's not forcing them in this moment. Right? And so he withdraws his power, and it says that he was astonished at their faithlessness. I mean, at the depth, the true depth of their offense of him. Amazed is the word, right? They were amazed at his teaching, and now he is amazed at their faithlessness. There's only two times in all of the New Testament where this word amazed that Jesus uses here is used. One of them is here for his just dumbfounded amazement at how they could be in the presence of Jesus and know about what he's been doing, his own people, and reject him. He's amazed at that. And then the other one is the complete opposite. There's an account of a Roman centurion whose child is dying. And that Roman centurion, who's supposed to be the enemy of the Jews and the enemy of Jesus, comes to him and says, I have so much faith in you, I believe if you just say a word right now that you will heal my child. And Jesus uses this same word. He was so amazed at that kind of faith. And I think that's fascinating. What is Jesus amazed by more than anything? Tremendous faith and tremendous faithlessness. That's what he is amazed by. And so, as I said, he doesn't waste any time there. He moves on. It's this quick moment in the life of Jesus. And yet I think there's something here today that is so important for us. All right, what's happening in this moment? Why did Jesus take his disciples there for them to see this? Because there's something they need to see, and there's something we need to see today. Right, what they saw as just ordinary is actually what makes Jesus so special. I want us to hear that today. What they saw as ordinary, just this regular, ordinary, average human being, this is what makes him special, right? It is his, Jesus' incredible humility that makes him such an amazing and good God. It's his willingness to become one of us. I mean, think about what he did for the first 30 years of his life before he began his ministry. He's not doing miracles. He's not teaching, right? If he had started doing that in his little town of Nazareth, I think they would have recognized a little bit more, but they didn't, right? No, he was just like one of the rest of the guys. Just an average, ordinary dude in their minds, right? Because this is the truth today. His willingness to become ordinary is what actually makes him extraordinary. Jesus' willingness to leave his throne. He's God of the universe. He is the creator of all. He was there at the beginning when God spoke the world into existence. He is holy and perfect and to be glorified in every possible way. And yet, what did he do? He lowered himself. He humbled himself and he became a man so that he could empathize with us, so that he could truly understand what we go through, human emotion, the things that we feel, so that he could connect with us in an intimate way that he never could have if he hadn't done that. I mean, isn't Christmas just an incredible reminder of this? That's the Christmas story, is it not? That Jesus was born in the flesh. I mean, can you imagine? I heard a pastor talk about this one time, and I was like, man, that's a great thought. Can you imagine what the angels must have been thinking as God the Father and Jesus in heaven were explaining this plan? Really? You're gonna do that for them? This is crazy. This doesn't make any sense. You're God. You don't lower yourself down to that level? This is what makes our God amazing. Because that is exactly what he does. And yet, again, I am amazed. I am amazed at how many people hear the stories of Jesus, hear the testimony of Christians, and yet over and over and over again reject Jesus. And again, the question is why? Why? That Greek word scandalizo, it can also be used in another form. It's the word scandalon. Scandalon. And that word is used of a stone that is rejected by a builder to be used in the building of some sort of structure. And so what would happen is they would go out to the quarry and they would look for the right stones to build the foundation of a home. And as they looked for those stones, they would look for blemishes, cracks, look for stones that were the right size. And if the stone did not meet the requirements, if it was too flawed, they would discard it. They wouldn't use it. Now, there's a verse in Psalm 118. Maybe some of you have heard this before. Maybe you have read this before. It goes like this: the stone the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. Jesus actually quotes this about himself in Matthew 21 in chapter 42, or verse 42. He quotes this about himself, saying that he is a stone that will be rejected. Not only is he just a stone, he is the stone, right? The cornerstone, the most foundational, important stone in the foundation. Without it, everything else crumbles and falls apart. He's showing them that he is going to be rejected. And why did they reject him? Why did they reject him then? And why do they reject him now? For the same reason that a builder rejected the building stone. Because in their mind, he's flawed. There's something I just can't get down with when it comes to Jesus. How in the world can I believe in a God who would do what he did? Right? Who looks just like everybody else in some ways. Right? How? And the reality is this: they're blinded by the truth. They're blinded by the truth because this is what makes Jesus special. It's his willingness to do that that actually makes him amazing. That even though, yes, he is God on high, he desired to do what was necessary to save us, and it required him to be humble. It required him to be humbled, right? And I think so many people think, man, isn't this whole Jesus thing just one God in a sea of other gods out there? Why this one? Why him? Why is he the one true way to finally having right relationship with God? Right? He's flawed. Just like every other God is flawed. Just like every other God is imperfect. Right? Why should I follow him? Right? He doesn't have the power to help me. So many people believe that. Oh, they hear about Jesus, they hear Christians talk about him, they hear about how he's transformed their life, but he doesn't have the power to transform me. He doesn't really have the power to do anything in my life. And at the end of the day, here's what's happening in people's lives. And this is what I want you to hear today, so badly. It is our pride. It is our human pride It was the pride of the people of Nazareth that looked at Jesus and said, there's nothing special about him. I don't need him in my life. We don't need him in our town. That drove him away and kept them from actually experiencing just this amazing relationship with him. Right? In people's pride, they don't see there's anything special about Jesus, right? And what's crazy is we look at God as flawed. People see religion as flawed. And in many ways, religion is flawed. But Jesus is not flawed. The problem is that we are flawed and we don't want to see that. We don't want to see that, right? And so in spite of all the evidence that we are flawed, in spite of all the warning systems, right? How did we start today? We reject him. And so my question as we close today is this. Is Christ a scandalon for you? Is Jesus a scandalon, right? Is he an embarrassment to you? Are you ashamed of him? And right now I'm talking to those of us who are believers, who are Christians, who say we're followers of Jesus. Is he a scandalon? Or do you boldly talk about him? Do you boldly proclaim the truth of the gospel to the people and the world around you? Right? We need to know this. And I think this is what Jesus was trying to show his disciples. Jesus has been offending people for 2,000 years. I don't believe they should be offended by him. But the reality is, in our pride, the gospel is offensive. The gospel says we are sinners. We don't deserve to go to heaven. We don't deserve to have right relationship with Jesus. But Jesus makes a way. He dies for us. He puts himself in our place so that we can truly have right relationship with him. So that we don't have to worry about performing anymore. So many people, that's what they think Christianity is about. It's about performance. It's about all the things you gotta do right in order to look good in the eyes of God. That's not the gospel. That's a false gospel. That's a works-based righteousness kind of gospel. The gospel says you can't do anything to make yourself look better to God because we're all just, we're depraved people. The thoughts we have, the things we do, if we got to do enough good to make up for the bad, we'll never do it. Jesus says you don't have to. You don't have to. I'm going to take care of it for you. Maybe today, maybe, you know, Christians, listen, we gotta stand firm. We gotta stand firm on the truth. We gotta show people that Jesus is special, that he is worth following. But maybe today you're here and you've just flat out rejected the idea of Jesus and you're still not sure that you can follow him. This is my plea today. I'm begging you today. Don't reject him. Don't allow him to be a scandalon in your life. I want to read you a verse. And truly, this is for you. If you don't believe, I want to read this to you. These are the words prophesied by the prophet Isaiah 700 years before Jesus came into this world. 700 years. We know that. It says he was despised and rejected by mankind. Talking about Jesus. A man of suffering and familiar with pain, like one from whom people hide their faces, he was despised and we held him in low esteem. Surely he took up our pain and bore our suffering, yet we considered him punished by God, stricken by him, and afflicted. Don't miss this last part. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. That's Jesus. That's Jesus. all of the punishment that we should have received, he takes. And we get his righteousness. We get to stand before God and look perfect, unblemished, because of what Jesus does for us, because he puts himself in our place. And you know what amazes me about Jesus? He knew he was going to be rejected. He knew it. He knew he would be rejected. He knew he would be despised. He knew there would be people who say, "Forget you, Jesus. I don't want to have anything to do with you." And he did it anyway. That is a God that I will follow. He is the truth and he is the answer. And I beg you today, if you have never believed in Christ and put your faith in him, make today the day. Begin to follow him. And you know what he'll do? You know, so many people, I hear this question. If I start following Jesus, does that mean I have to stop doing X, Y, or Z? Right, and you could go down a whole list of all the things that, right, that lots of people believe, well, if you're a Christian, you better stop doing that. You better stop doing it immediately. Do I have to stop doing that before I can come into faith and before I can come into relationship with Jesus? The answer is no. And I'll cite the example that I've cited many times before. There was a thief on a cross next to Jesus as he died. And that thief put his faith and his trust in Jesus. In the last breath that he had, he was a criminal, probably a murderer, probably did so many heinous acts in his life. And in that moment, you know what Jesus said to him? "It is finished. Today, you will be with me in paradise." Do you have to get your act together before you come to Jesus? No. No. You just have to put your faith and trust in him. And from that point forward, here's what's going to happen. I love this. Make this connection with me. Jesus, the carpenter, the tecton, the architect, the builder, will begin to work on your life. He will begin to transform you. He will build you into the person that you were always meant to be, that God always created you to be. But you gotta come to him first. Come. And that's my encouragement to you. Come in your brokenness, come with your flaws. Because while Nazareth might have said he was flawed, he isn't. And he is big enough to handle whatever flaws you got going on. He has handled mine for many years. Promise you he can handle yours.